The little book, Intelligent Design, by William Dembski, has permanized in literature an episode from the animated television series The Simpsons. Marge tries to tell her husband, Homer, that she is pregnant. That she is pregnant with their third child. And she tries to tell him. And he says, "Can't talk now, I'm praying." This was his prayer. "Dear Lord, the gods have been good to me, and I am thankful. For the first time in my life, everything is absolutely perfect the way it is. So here's the deal. You freeze everything as it is, and I won't ask for anything more. If that is okay, please give me absolutely no sign." Pause. Pause. Okay, deal. "In gratitude, I present to you this offering of cookies and milk. If you want me to eat them for you, please give me no sign." Pause. "Thy will be done." I've been preaching on Romans 1, 21, 22, where God indicates he's fed up with being ignored. And he has, in response, turned his wrath loose now, not sometime in the future, now. And removed the faculty, the capacity to see him, recognize him, be aware of his reality, his presence, his power, worship him and be thankful. And having removed the capacity, the result is a malicious kind of self-deception. We spend a lot of time on the Greek words. Vain reasonings. And the word senseless. In the Greek, the removal of sense, insight. The senseless hearts darkened, professing themselves to be wise. They become, the translation is fools, but the Greek word is the cognate of our word for moron. And we have demonstrated the problem of scientism that has gripped this Western world. Not science. I stand in front of you, thanks to science, with a stent in my heart and perfect health as a result of that medical marvel that in years past was not available, and I probably wouldn't be here. I stand in front of you, the living exhibit of a miracle that we have cataloged week after week as the announcement of imminent death 10 to 14 months. Of prostate cancer in the worst phase, double 10 Gleason. Healed by God's power, and have cataloged it to you week after week, until the doctor, when my PSA dropped to 1.2, told me, "Don't come back until June." No way. Refusing even to do a biopsy. And as I told you last Sunday, I took the test last week, 0.6. I'll guarantee you, most of you 40-year-olds in this congregation can't match 0.6. But we could catalog this miracle ad infinitum. And the world without any capacity to recognize God and ruling Him out of this universe, which began really with Spinoza and Schleiermacher. And Spinoza's God is the God that Einstein embraced. A pantheism that credits this world with ultimate reality. Carl Sagan's cosmos. This is all there is, all there ever was, and all there ever will be. Once that capacity is gone, they can find an explanation for anything. Misdiagnosis. Something else. And we live in an age, starting with Spinoza and ending with the modern tunnel of scientism that has ruled God out of the equation. He's not even allowed to be considered an option. And we've been weeks illustrating that as we camped out on this verse to give evidence of the proof of what Paul said. Today, this is not part of the Roman series. This is my annual Easter message. We wove it in the fourth verse of Romans 1, because that's where Paul is talking about the power of God being revealed in the gospel by the resurrection of God, resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And at this point last year, we were at Romans 1:4. I decided today to not hand out any text of Romans. I'm just going to shift the page from what's been going on for weeks of showing you the utter incapacity of this age clamped into a tunnel. Science is okay. Scientism says the only source of truth is this material world. And scientism says the only way to find truth is that scientific method. And all other avenues to truth and all other areas than this, there is no other area. There is no great other. This is it. Sagan again. All that ever was, is, and ever will be, this cosmos. And once those who look at the same creation that ought to create a marvelous sense of awe that even primitive people had, make God mad enough, He withdraws the capacity. And they become colossal fools with some of the most screwball ideas. And we have shown you some of the theories of the past few weeks that make a belief in the resurrection look like a normal expression. Some of the wildest theories, like the production of life. One chance in a billion. The chances of stars forming, without which there'd be no life, because that's where hydrogen producing helium. And the processes that follow give you the basis of life. What was it? One with 229 zeros behind it? Mind-boggling for even a star to form, without which there would be no. The Big Bang, you read one book and that's the way it happened, because the Catholic Church embraced it early on. Lerner's book says the Big Bang never happened. And when I continue the Roman series, I will present to you some galaxies that are older by their own measuring devices than the Big Bang. So something banged them before the banger got to the Big Bang. But that's not the subject today. We're not here to show how marvelously gifted, genius, ability men and women can become utter fools in their blind. They're as blind as the medieval church that closed its mind to science. They rule God out of the universe. I'm here to say, and I did illustrate it with Simpson, signs are a joke. If it be your will, don't show me a sign. Pause. No lightning bolt occurred. No earthquake happened. So now I know God's will. Mockery of signs. They asked Jesus for a sign. Pharisees did. He said, there won't be any sign given you. Just once. Once and only once will God stoop down and give you a sign and satisfy that need to signify and provide a basis for believing. It's only one, and it's a good one. And thank God he did. And in spite of the separation of faith from science and faith from reality by this modern tunnel vision world, God did intrude into history. God did, as a source outside of history, enter it and provide a sign. He said it'll be the sign of Jonah. And he took a picture of type from the Old Testament of Jonah in the belly of the whale, 72 hours and out. I don't care whether you believe it's literal truth or not. I mean, I've read all the objections scientifically that there's no fish that's known that could swallow a man, and that he couldn't live inside the fish for 3 days. That's not the miracle to me. I mean, the miracle is not that there's some fish we don't yet know about. I mean, there's a living fossil that was discovered off the coast of Africa not long ago. The fossil that the science told you was the predecessor to moving from fish to manhood, with this little fish that had a flapper tail and some stumps that looked like arms in their concept of homology. And this was the fossil that showed up in all kinds of textbooks. This was the predecessor. This was the link between fish and land creatures, until they brought one up in a net off of Africa a few years ago. And now, this living fossil, is suddenly destroying their theory, because their theory of mutation and natural selection requires that that which mutates creates a better ability to survive, and thus the predecessor dies off, and you can't have a fossil still living. Except me. To me, the great miracle is that whatever fish it was happened to be there with its mouth open when they threw Jonah overboard. That to me is a miracle. And if you believe God can create from nothing and speak the worlds into existence, Genesis 1, and say, light be, and there it was, then I'm going to be troubled once I believe that. And he could speak fish be, one like they ain't ever been. I mean, it could have a Ritz-Carlton drawing room in its stomach. It's obviously a miracle in process, because that particular fish was right there at that moment when Jonah went overboard. Now, whether you want to believe it's real, which I do, because I have a basis for believing in miracles, or a myth, Jesus said the purpose of that, as a story and a type in the record of God's revelation of his will, was to give in dramatic form a pre-statement of the one sign God would deign to give to prove His power, His control, His reality. And Jesus went on to interpret it, as Jonah was in the whale, so would he be in the grave and come out again in 3 days. That was declared by Jesus to be the only sign. Paul was lucky he got another one. My dad was lucky. In a coma he received a vision. Across this world people have been fortunate as God in His grace has provided other convincing personal and individual signs that give momentum to their faith. But the only one God bound to give, and the one that He gave, and the only one that we're entitled to say God gave this as a basis for faith is the resurrection. Now, one of the great hymns of the church, He lives. You ask me how I know He lives? He lives within my heart. Great for you, nothing for me. Doesn't prove a thing. Doesn't prove a thing. Except to you. Or if there's a life change, we can deduce from that testimony. But it is not a sign, objective, that's available for everyone to find. And the very song has become an excuse for most Christians not doing the hard work of settling the fact of the resurrection. When I indict those who do not believe in the resurrection, because I can ask them 5 to 15 questions and find they have never read 5 to 15 hours of solid literature as evidence of this historic fact, the same indictment goes to most Christians. They take the easy way and use their subjective experience. I stood amazed at Shinto sect meetings in Japan as I watched them exhibit what in New Testament Greek is called the glossolalia, and the Pentecostals and the Charismatics called the gift of tongues, speaking in other tongues. I watched Shinto sect meetings in frenzy begin to speak in unintelligible phrases, just like an old-fashioned Pentecostal camp meeting. That does not nullify the reality of the Pentecost experience. I'm just saying that's not the absolute sign. It's a wonderful experience for you to have. God said there's one basis for faith in Jesus Christ. There's one basis, one sign, only one He would give, available to everybody, just like any other historic event. It can be looked at for the evidence, and most people won't do it. But God, through His Son, said, that is the only sign I'm going to give you for faith. And it's not a negative sign like Simpson's. God, if you're alive, don't let Him raise. When He goes in the tomb, I want proof now that you're alive, God. And the sign I want is that He doesn't come out of the tomb. And that's about as solid a basis as some people's faith. God humbled Himself and said, okay, I'm going to give you a sign. If you want it, it's not just a miracle. That's the point I'm making. The resurrection is a miracle. But it's not just a miracle. It's a sign. It signifies something. And Jesus said to him, when it happens, I'll go away and I'll come back, speaking in the context of His death and resurrection. And when I return from the grave, so to speak, you will believe my words. God, who created this inquiring mind that's wasted and from which He will withdraw the capacity to recognize Him when you confront the truth and just refuse, as R.C. Sproul says, the reason for atheism is not the facts. It's a psychological state. We do not want to recognize a sovereign. We don't like God's sovereignty. We want to be in control. As Stephen Hawking said, when I can understand it, I'm the master of it. We want to be in control. We don't like the idea that there's a big boss out there that we have to please. Huxley reveled in the fact that he had removed any guilt of sin because the world doesn't condemn the natural world. It just is. We don't want a boss. Well, there is one who created this mind of ours and said, okay, I'll give you a sign. The death and resurrection of Jesus. That's the basis of all our faith. Paul said to the Corinthians, if there be no resurrection, we have no faith. If there be no resurrection, we're liars. We're false witnesses. For we've testified of God that He raised up the Christ. Without the resurrection, the disciples were a scattered band. There would have been no Christian church. Wasn't Jesus' ethical teaching that brought the church into existence? It was the resurrection that took a broken down, defeated, cowardly bunch of disciples who could not stand as a group, transformed them. And the message they preached was resurrection. They're in the streets. The very first day on the day of Pentecost. This Jesus, whom ye have crucified, hath God raised up, whereof we all are witnesses. This is in the city of Jerusalem, 7 weeks after the event. Mobs on the streets. They try to shut him up as they continue to preach through Acts. You hanged him on a tree and desired a murderer to be granted unto you. But God raised him up. That was the message. Sorry, like it or lump it. I remember saying to Lex Miller, the New Zealand neo-orthodox ethical theologian that had studied under Karl Barth in Germany, and Reinhold Niebuhr, he was his assistant at Union, head of the religion department at Stanford, guided me through my doctoral dissertation on Reinhold Niebuhr, crying as we left on the quad. One of the greatest men that I have ever known. And I said to him, we got that close, I said, Lex, how can you believe, or you claim, and I believe you claim to believe, and I believe it, that you do, that God spoke and these universes came into existence. And yet, you won't base your faith on the resurrection. He said to me, Gene, I'm so afraid it can't be supported. I don't want to risk my faith on that. Well, God did. That's what God said would be the only sign. Now, I lost my faith in college. I lost it. Not, I didn't turn atheistic, I became agnostic. I started out in geology and history. My major history, my minor, the physical sciences. I remember the shock of the first class in geology. And I had this tunnel vision pressure. I couldn't really make it academically until I abandoned this primitive, empty-headed view of the ignorant of a Jesus Christ that was supernatural. I've told you this story probably every year. I ultimately finished at Stanford with scholarships. I became the reader of the head of the history department, Lou Oliver. Now, they choose their best students and make him essentially their flunky, but it's an assistant. You grade the papers and you are their reader. You read the tests. And if they require the students to read 5 or 10 books a week, you've got to be ahead of them. And he said to me, sitting in his office, "Gene, I don't understand. I look at your grades, your academic record, I read your papers, I made you my reader, obviously because of your academic quality, and I can't figure it out. It puzzles me. How you hold on to a faith in Jesus as a supernatural being." And then he sort of sat back like he had resolved a major problem. And he said, "I finally have concluded it has to be a vestigial emotional tie to your father." Because he knew my father was a pastor in the Assemblies of God Church in Oroville. In other words, I'm relegated in just one small part of my being to a nut list explainable by an only child syndrome connection to my father. The put down, we've been teaching it for weeks. The put down, belief in the miracle, somehow puts you in the fringe of those that can only be compared to a racist who decides that because of your color, you can never, which I shock some of you by reading from Darwin and Huxley that was their view. You could cut the air with a knife in here when I read the quotes of Darwin and Huxley about inferior races and their natural selection ultimately doing away with the savage races like the Afro-Americans and the Asians with their snide British drawing room and European superiority attitude. That's what I confronted. Couldn't really gain my wings as an academician with such belief. Professorships, grants, promotions are based in today's world on acceptance of Darwinism. Creationists are inferior beings. And belief in the resurrection, impossible. And in order to be intellectually accepted, I had to accept their view of Christ. He was a good and wise teacher, a founder of religion, like the Gautama Buddha. The Gautama Buddha, a prince, there are lots of Buddhas now, but the founder of Buddhism was a prince in England, in India, not England, India, who, as his family was raised, decided to seek deliverance from what they call Tanya, loosely translated thirst, which is an identity with this material world, and he tried the stringent suffering path of the yogi. He then tried the path of sensuality and pleasure, and he then derived what he called his middle path or middle road, the Eightfold Path. And their idea of nirvana or salvation is to lose any conscious contact with this world, which is the source of the thirst that leads to man on the treadmill of the wheel of life, seeking himself first. And they go into a trance-like state in which they lose any connection with this world and have become one, and ultimate reality to them is that which is behind all that. They won't even differentiate it by giving it a name. The that which is behind all that. And he founded Buddhism from such a nirvana experience that was an eightfold path that he worked out. And having achieved that state of unconscious identity with ultimate reality, the wheel of life stopped, karma stopped, And he lived out his life and then became one with ultimate reality. Buddhism started with this founder, a historic creature, an historic person. Who did that? Confucius? He did a logical analysis of society, offered a pattern that would solve social problems. They tried it in one city, didn't work. He said they didn't do it right. And I used to wear a shirt when I was a teenager with Confucius says. And I'm sure a lot of things were attributed to him that he didn't say, at least on my shirts. But Confucius did a logical analysis of society, was a founder of religion that came out of this logical analysis that would answer social and society's problems. Muhammad, I could go to Zoroaster, Taoism, others, but these are the prominent ones that come to the mind of most regular people. Muhammad founded the Islamic faith. The Islamic people, or Muslims, do not worship Muhammad. There's only one God, Allah, Muhammad, his prophet. And he received visions in the desert that he put into the Quran, which is their holy book. And as a founder of religion, these three, Muhammad, Confucius, and Buddha, my professor says Jesus belongs there. Another good and wise teacher who founded a religion. The only problem, I had studied enough as a kid. I'd always had a prying mind. I knew there was something wrong with what they were saying. This would get me in to the accepted academic view. Don't condemn Jesus. Just move him sideways and put him in this catalog of respected, good and wise teachers, founders of religion. There's a problem with that. And I'm way ahead of my initial questions because it didn't ring. I went on. I studied with Spiegelberg in a unit minor at Stanford on my PhD, who's probably the world's expert on Vedanta religions and Eastern religions, characterized by having the world's largest Tibetan ghost trap collection. I studied an individual study with Kishimoto, who was on a visiting professorship at Stanford, who took Anasaki's place as the world expert on Shintoism and Buddhism. So I continued to pursue this well into the later years of graduate work. But to jump through it all and just hand it out to you, I ended up writing six little books entitled Jesus Christ, Supernut, or Supernatural. You see, I respect the Jews. The lawyers are here. Maybe the only trial in history where the condemnation came and without a trial it occurred in the Holocaust. But in maybe the most famous trial in the history of mankind, he was condemned, not for what he did. They couldn't find anything to lay at his charge. Otherwise, Pilate would have been a little tougher on him than he was. He was condemned for who he said he was, and from my view, who he was. The trial hinged on who he claimed to be. Nothing was more sacred than the high priest's garments. He was never allowed to mar them in any manner for personal reasons. He was required, as a testament to being in the presence of a blasphemer, to rip it apart. And the high priest asked Jesus if he had made the claims that were charged to him. And he said, "Thou hast said, you said it." Es lo que yo dije, if you'd been speaking Spanish. That's what I said. Quello che ho detto. And when he admitted these claims about himself, Caiaphas rent his garments apart. I need to hear no more. Blasphemer. None of these men, these respected founders, claim to be God. None of them. Gautama Buddha was facing death and his disciples were lamenting the possibility and he said, my death means nothing. All I leave you is the way. And it worked for me. You try it, it'll work for you. Apart from himself, he left a disciplined spiritual process that is the Eightfold Path that he said, the way, I'm not important. It's in his own sermons. The Buddha tripart package of scripture has him saying it. I do not amount to anything. I'm unimportant. The way is what I leave you. No claim of divinity. Muhammad never once claimed divinity. One God, Allah. I'm his prophet. Confucius, they asked him about the next life. He said, I can't even solve the problems of this life. Don't ask me about the next life. Light years removed from some assumption of divinity. Never once claiming any extra human other than what is the whole record of the Old Testament, in Muhammad's case, a recipient of revelation from the one God. And Muhammad is always saying, the Lord says. He's not saying, I say. Allah hath revealed this. You try to put Jesus in that camp, you run into a quandary. Now, if you're going to call him good and wise, I have a right to say on what basis. And the answer is going to be what he said and what he did. He said and did wise and good things. That's what they're going to lay down on you. Right? Okay. What's your source? We're dealing with a historic person who said and did good things, and I'm being asked to reduce him down to a good and wise teacher. So where do I go for what he said and did to find this goodness and this wisdom? Now, ironically, 99 times out of 100, they're going to take you to the Gospels. And they're going to say, well, that's the familiar source. And if they're in the Gospels, superabundantly, I will illustrate and can illustrate what I'm about to say. But I don't care what source you pick. Doesn't matter to me. The Gospels. Look, this church has accumulated more manuscripts than anybody. In any church in private hands, we've assembled them. I don't care what you go to. Luke says when he wrote, he sat down to write a record. And he says many have written or expressed themselves on this, and he's going to write a true record. Mark was the first one to write. Well, I know that Jesus Seminar, trying to support their position, will tell you they don't have any documents past the second century. Well, the Magdalene fragment. And the seventh cave of Qumran takes us back before 70 AD. Mark wrote before Matthew and Luke, because we can find in Matthew and Luke quotes from Mark. And we will find also in these hymns, things that circulated as just hymns of the church. Just like we do now, we put to song truths from the Bible. They put to song truths from the earliest experience. You will also find a mysterious change in the Greek of style. You can tell when Matthew and Luke are quoting Mark, and you can also tell when there's a third source that's being quoted in common, but different in style than Mark or their own style. And this became the basis for the hypothetical Q document from the German word Quelle, which is source. And you go into some of the literature of the Jesus Seminar, which is, in my judgment, the worst prostitution of academic integrity that I can see anywhere around, because they do not disclose what they're really doing. And they're getting all in the tunnel vision of today to get all the news. A bunch of true academics that are trying to find what are the valid sources of Scripture. They don't tell you that they have an a priori presupposition before they start out. And they're looking for a non-offensive Jesus that will fit into the one world and fit in with respect and no antagonism or confrontationism with all these other founders of religion. Same thing I confronted years ago. And they have this a priori prejudice that they vote on the manuscripts. Now, after their votes, Mark only is able to retain 3%. Doesn't matter what the manuscripts say. Only 3% of Mark is valid because they vote with black balls and white balls and some neutral ball. Anyway, marbles determine it. Not marbles in their head, but they actually vote with marbles or little round balls. Before they start, it is agreed. Any passage gets a black ball that reports a miracle. Because miracles can't happen. Therefore, if there's a passage that reports a miracle, it obviously is not a valid record. You understand that? And prophecy is a miracle. Because nobody can foretell the future. So any reference to an Old Testament prophecy or any statement of future happening, blackball, because that again is gullible miracle. Jesus is the only preacher not allowed to quote Scripture. Because if there's a passage that quotes an Old Testament Scripture, that is tinged with prophecy, which is not allowable, so it's blackballed. It isn't examined on paleography, radiocarbon, or any of those matters. It must be rejected on these presuppositions. And since they've already decided that these writers are pseudo-epigrams, that whoever wrote them was a liar, claiming to be Mark, Luke, and Matthew, because they have decided it's not written until the second or third century, and therefore the writer is not only a liar, immediately casting doubt on the record and their credibility, and allowing the Jesus Seminar to have their a priori credibility substituted. Since they've decided they weren't written until the second or third century, passed on by memory, no one can remember long narratives. Therefore, if it is part of a narrative, you leave it out. Got that? If it's part of a narrative, it's rejected. Thrown out. I mean, you've heard this message 25 times. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
So out go miracles, out go prophecy, out go Old Testament quotations, and out go narratives. Prodigal son. That beautiful story of the prodigal son? Gotta go. Because it's a narrative. It's part of a story too long to be remembered. And when you get done ditching all of those, based on their a priori assumption, you got 3% of Mark left. True scholars have identified the Magdalene manuscript back in the first century by paleography. You can go up here and look at the changing in style of writing. And there are areas when they made their S's a certain way. We had a humorous passage up here in a Bible that's open that only I would allow. But in Old English, when the letter S was the first letter of a word, they used to write it like a F. And there is a passage in prophecy in the New Testament in what we call the Vinegar Bible that is famous because it substitutes the word vinegar for vineyard, and thus is a very rare Bible for that reason. But we happen to have it open to the passage that shows at the top heading the parable of the vinegar. But as you read down, it has that prophetic passage concerning the tribulation, where it would be terrible to be caught in that terror, that terrific outpouring of wrath, and be a mother with a suckling child. So the phrase opens, and it has, with capital letter on the word suck, woe to them that suck in those days. Well, the Old English makes it look like a word that would take me off the air and put you out of business, Cal, if I were to say it. But I knew that I had a church full of sinners that needed the messages because of the lines that gathered up in front of that Bible. And people who didn't know the changing in paleographic writing style. I even had an off-duty policeman here as a guard standing there aghast. I can't believe that that's in the Bible. Ignore those scholarly bases. Ignore all of it. That's what the Jesus Seminar does. Sorry, we know when the Qumran caves were closed. We know when Titus took Jerusalem. We got a fixed date that pushes them back before 70 A.D. Scholarship has gone on. But the Jesus Seminar people will put in their bibliography the so-called Q document. There isn't any such thing. There is no Q document. They've never found it. In the Nag Hammadi finds of Gnostic Gospels, they think the Gospel of Thomas might be a candidate. Nobody's ever found the so-called Q document. But somewhere, Matthew and Luke had access to it and are quoting from it. One of the early church fathers says that Matthew wrote down the sayings of Jesus while he traveled with him, not in Greek, just as clear as a bell, yet we know the earliest manuscript of Matthew is in Greek. Some have postulated that Matthew, the tax collector, the scribal type that was used to keeping books, would be the logical one to write down the sayings of Jesus as they traveled around, and that wherever it might be found, a document in either Aramaic or Hebrew might be and may still be dug up somewhere. The source of these unknown source quotations that are inside Matthew and Luke and obviously prove another source. I don't care if you take the sayings of the fathers. You take my 25 years preaching here, you will pretty much be able to assemble a King James Version from the number of verses that I have quoted, because that's the common source. You can read the sermons, mountains of them, of early church fathers. Ignatius, the famous martyr, appointed to the church at Ephesus by John the Apostle. Polycarp, these earliest church fathers, their sermons abound, and they quote from manuscripts that they had that have subsequently been lost, and we can go to their quotes and find little minor things that suggest they had a source earlier than the earliest manuscripts that are used to translate most of our versions of the Bible. And as you will see as you go through the Bible tour, the three oldest extant Bibles in the world, the Vaticanus, the Sinaiticus, 4th century, 340 A.D., approximately, if it was done at the Scriptorium in Caesarea, and the 5th century Alexandrinus. We have one of the few sets. There's only one original of each of them, two in the British Museum, one at Vatican Library in Rome. But we're one of the few people that have copies of all three, made from those fragile papers or fragile pieces of skin, vellum, and made available to a few institutions and libraries, and we have copies of all three. These are the oldest complete Bibles in existence in the world. Yet we know we have sermons of fathers that are quoting from an earlier source. I can go on. I'm saying I don't care. Pick your own source. You're going to tell me Jesus is a good and wise teacher? On what basis? Where are you getting his words and a description of his deeds that let you say he's good and wise? And I will take the challenge and go there with you, including the Jesus Seminar reduction. Somewhere in any one of these sources, you will find Jesus making the following kinds of claims about himself, any one of which puts him in the nut fringe. He doesn't belong with Muhammad, Confucius, or Buddha. He belongs with Father Divine. He belongs with the nuts we've relegated to religious wonderland. He thought he was perfect. Doesn't matter whether he was or not. He thought he was. Thomas Carlyle, the philosopher, said, of all acts of man, repentance is the most divine. And the greatest of all sins is to be conscious of none. Think of it. You know any saint in the world? That thought he was never wrong? Usually it's a spiritual experience like Isaiah had. Woe is me, I'm undone, when he saw God. Abraham, I'm not worthy. Moses, I can't even speak. Jeremiah, I'm but a child. David, I'm not worthy of the least of thy mercies. What's your natural instinct towards someone that's never, never wrong? They never do anything wrong. They're perfect. Am I the only person who wants to? Our natural instinct tells us we don't make saints. When we look back and see, we then credit perfection to them. But if they go around acting like they're without fault, I mean, if the Pope strode around like this, if he walked like Bush, he wouldn't be revered half as much. We just, you know, we love to make saints of these humbling people that have such great power and wear the mantle so humbly. I'm not mocking, I'm just stating a fact. Jesus thought he was perfect. Think not that I've come to destroy the law, God's standard of perfection. I've come to fulfill it. You say you're quoting the gospel. Well, give me your source. I'll find the same things. He forgave sin. A few people have concluded, I got a ring in my mic. A few people have concluded, the Lord forgive thee on a basis. He just looked at him, he looked at the embodiment of perfection, the Pharisees, and says, you're like whited sepulchres. painted white on the outside, but full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Hypocrites. In comes the woman taken in adultery. He forgives her sins. To the most despised man in town, Zacchaeus, forgives his sins. He didn't say, "The Lord forgive thee. Thy sins be forgiven." Only someone he judges without any remorse, already named as judgment of the hypocrites. You strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. To judge is a tough position. We've created a society where they do it. And they're robed in black and have all this stuff in front. A ritual that recognizes that it's being done from a position, because no mortal man has the ability to sit in judgment, because we're all guilty. As Jesus said to those that pushed the woman in adultery, "Let him without a sin among you cast the first stone." Along comes the rich young ruler and says, "Good rabbi, good master." He stops him dead. "Why callest thou me good? There's none good but God. If you're going to call me good, don't just call me good rabbi. Recognize that only God can be good, so go all the way." He wasn't denying his goodness. His prayer, that other prayer, he never prayed. Every prayer, though it's so difficult in different contexts, every prayer by these other founders, they taught it to their disciples to pray, and they prayed it with them. Jesus never prayed what we call the Lord's Prayer. It wasn't his prayer, it was the disciples' prayer. He said, "When ye pray, say this." And included in that prayer, "Forgive us our trespasses." He never prayed that prayer. His prayer is in John 17. "Father, I have finished the work you gave me to do. Now restore me to the glory that I had before." It reeks with self-presumption of no sense of moral inadequacy. He never once can be found exhibiting what is the mark of a saint. I just went through the catalog from Isaiah. The mark of a saint. Never once does he exhibit a sense of moral inadequacy. The agony of his prayer was, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me, but nevertheless not as I will, but thine." He compared himself to the lamb in a context of Jewish history where to offer a lamb with defects was to invite death from God. He substituted himself in imagery as the perfect lamb. So in focus in the Jewish faith on this Passover day. He thought he was perfect. He seated authority in himself. These other founders say, "The Lord said." He seated authority in himself. Not some criteria outside. The Gautama Buddha pointed to an experience that he had and said, "You try it, it'll work for you." An objective, separate source of authority. Confucius made a logical analysis of society. Said, "Try it, it'll work." Something separate from himself. Muhammad claimed visions. "Allah showed me this, I've written it down." He did not see the authority in himself. Jesus went around saying, "Behold, you've heard it said unto you, but now I say." You build on what I say, you build on a rock, you build on anything else, you build on sand. He didn't invoke God to forgive sins, as I've already said. He did it. He seated authority in himself. He spoke of the eternal world from the inside. He didn't talk about it as Muhammad did, because of visions, and as Confucius refused to do because he didn't know, and as having touched it with an experience. He talked familiarly, the way I talk about my home. He makes wild, crazy statements like, before Abraham was, I was. I was there when Satan was cast down. There's more joy in heaven over one sinner repentant. He talks with a familiarity that expects me to believe that he had an eternal existence and this is temporary and then he's going to go back. Boy, we're having sound problems. Now I've lost part of my microphone. I haven't got time to fix it. You guys have to control it without the puff. There's a difference between talking about eternity from a vision and an experience of having touched it and expecting me to believe. What would you think if your pastor walked out here today and said, before Abraham was, I was. I've been around forever. He put himself, the center of the universe, of the religious universe. Not these others. Gautama Buddha said, I don't matter. I'll leave you the way. Confucius, here's the pattern. Try it. Muhammad, one God Allah. He's revealed his pathway to me. I've written it down. My criteria of authority is visions. Jesus put himself the center. That's why it's so weird to try to think he came with some new ethic. I can find all of his ethical teachings, even in the Sermon on the Mount, in the richer period of the Pharisees following the Maccabean Rebellion. Jesus put himself the center. I'm the way. I'm the truth. By me, if any man enter in, shall be saved. I'm the water of life. I'm the door. Go any other way, you're a thief and a robber. I am the light of the world. He didn't say, follow my way. He went by a fisherman and said, follow me. He went by a tax collector and said, follow me. And if you don't take up your cross, and if you prefer family, father, mother, wife, children, and your own life to me, you can't be my disciple. This place would empty real quick if I turned from emphasizing God's word that we both must bow to claiming that I am the way, the truth, and the life. Forsake father, mother, wife, children for me. Patty, the attorney, and Melissa, my wife, would figure out a way to get me committed. Yet that's what Jesus went around doing. Put himself the center. He said there's something wrong with the world that can only be made right by me dying. His death straightened something out wrong with the whole world. Talk about self-centered existence. And he did it in the context where he was teaching people who knew the concept of kinsman redeemer, who knew the concept of a ransom, and he said that his death somehow ransomed and set right and satisfied and removed the barrier to being acceptable and accessible by God and to God, only made possible by his death as the sacrificial lamb was on Passover for a year. His death enabled the world to be set right again by God. And he prophesied that this death would be followed by resurrection. I've left one out. I don't like a six because I'm running out of time. That's enough. Any mortal man, had any one of these respected founders made claims like that about himself, they would have been relegated to the nut pile. Yet I'm being asked, and was asked, as the cost of acceptability in this tunnel scientism academic world, it's okay to believe in Jesus, get the miracles out of it, and just treat him as a good and wise teacher. With claims like this, he could be good in that he believed honestly these impossible things about himself, but he's nuts. You've got to be nuttier than a fruitcake to believe those things about yourself as a mortal man. But he could be good, just nutty. He could be wise enough to know that this is tomfoolery, but if he's wise enough to pull it off, he's the best con artist of the century. So he's wise, but not good. Because it's a con job. That's why I wrote the book. Jesus Christ, Super Nut, or Supernatural. As C.S. Lewis has said, when you confront the only Christ to be found in history, you're painted into a corner. You got to believe in this man who is the equivalent of someone that thinks he's a fried egg, or you got to accept him for what he says he is. And these six, as bad as I hate this number, these six alone, I want to tell you something. Sam. If Sam thought he was perfect and could convince me that what he thought's right, if he was perfect, if he was the source of all authority, don't need any other source, when he says it, that's it. If he does and has been there and knows where we're all going, and can talk about eternity from the other side, he's better than that woman with the tarot cards on TV every night. If eternal life is dependent upon worshiping him and accepting him and following him and doing what he says, and if I can't be set right except the death that he died, if that could be true, that's all the definition of God I need. The philosophers can speculate. Oral Roberts can see him 700 feet high. Size is irrelevant. That's all I need for a starting point for God. A person like that, in history, for which there is a record I can spend my life seeking after to find what he really said is the source of authority, that's enough God for me. I can tell you, if Sam said those things, I would be sympathizing with Pat, and Patty and I would try to figure out how to reason with Sam, and we'd begin to believe that his bicycle fall did something for which the prayers of the world has not yet solved. You follow me?
Yes, sir.
But if Sam said, when I die, 3 days later, I'm coming out of the tomb, I'm going to visit the tomb. And if Sam comes out and subsequently sails off in the blue, telling me, you'll come back again that way sometime, I'm taking another look at Sam. He's maybe more than the Sam I met. Even old Go See Craig down here. Craig's been my friend for years. If Craig made these claims about himself, I would ask his ranger son to tie him up and bring him to my house so I could reason with him a while. If I made these claims about myself, I'd expect you to vote me out as pastor. What have I proven? That these super snide professors that wanted me to substitute a good and wise teacher for a supernatural Jesus didn't know beans about the only Christ to be found in history. They created one of their own mental theory, professing to be wise, became morons. They had never looked. They didn't know a thing about Jesus. I admire the Jew of the first century who said, and ripped his clothing to make these claims is blasphemy. Only God can make these claims. Jesus made them. You therefore are forced in a corner. And I hate objective historians. There is no such thing as objectivity. Historic certainty is impossible. I got a history major. The definition of historic certainty is every logically possible piece of evidence is there. And when you can no longer be an eyewitness is a logical possible piece of evidence, but you can't be that because it's past. So there is no such thing as historic certainty. It's always relative. And when you sit on a jury, the evidence relative is presented. Getting more complicated as the years go on with DNA and other things. Absolute certainty is not there. But psychological certainty is something that happens from exposure to the evidence. Just, if you don't believe that, just try to pick a discussion at random about whether or not O.J. Simpson was guilty. Everybody's got their psychological certainty. And the media is prone to reach it before the trial is held and established in the mind of everybody. Psychological certainty occurs from exposure until the relative I'm not sure changes to I'm sure one way or the other. 2,000 years, the fact that even today you can hardly drive anyone to have the guts to say Jesus Christ was a nut or a wise faker. The profoundness of his influence, the quality of men who have died on the testimony of this fact, it would seem to me that if this were true, you have the focal point of history, the culmination of the Hebraic record of revelation, and it's worth a look. Because if true, God strode among us. If not true, we have a nut who is good because we can pick a few of his sayings and put them on a t-shirt like Confucius, or a wise faker. I came to the conclusion I had to settle it. 3.5 years of hard study. That began my language studies in Greek and the classical languages. 3.5 hard years. And I remember the day I was a state inspector in a cannery and I laid the last book down. And I said, there is no other possible explanation. He came out of that grave. He came out of that grave. I have yet to meet in a lifetime one person that denies the resurrection. But what, as I said earlier, I can ask 5 to 15 questions. And no, they have never looked at the basic evidence for it. No, they start out on the premise, like the Jesus Seminar, the resurrection cannot occur, therefore it didn't occur. Therefore, anybody that reports it's a liar, not worth reading, because the resurrection can't occur, therefore it didn't occur. Anybody says it did, the poor reporter, gullible fool, not worth reading, because the resurrection can't occur, didn't occur. Anybody reports it's a liar, because the resurrection can't occur, didn't occur. Anybody reports it's a liar, you don't read it, got it? So impossible, we're not going to look. And you go on living a life accordingly. Now, I had to look. And God said, as I started this message, that's the only sign He's going to give you. All I want to accomplish today, because I've hurried through this message for several years, and I wanted to return to a 2-Sunday presentation. All I want to do today is say, you don't have the choice if you're going to make an opinion. Tell me you don't know anything about Jesus. Tell me what a companion doctoral fellow at Stanford told me before he went to be dean at New York University, having completed his doctorate alongside me, and we studied together often. He said, "Gene, I admit, you've got me boxed in. I admit, I don't know anything about Jesus. I just assumed what they told me. He's a good and wise teacher. You've convinced me that it's more than that. But I don't want to look at the resurrection. Because the evidence, if the resurrection happened, no longer nut but good, fraud but wise, but a good and wise, truthful describer and revealer of his nature. If this is true, God is written all over it. And only a God can say this. And only a God goes in the grave and comes out again. The resurrection validates it. As Paul said to the philosophers on Mars Hill in the book of Acts later, you got an image, you're so afraid of missing the God, you got an image to an unknown God. Let me tell you who he is. The one that was authenticated by the resurrection. That's the proof of his rights. Otherwise he must be relegated to nuts or fraud. The proof is the resurrection. I looked. I'm convinced. My life changed. I spent my life heralding the evidence, trying to do it in an hour. Next Sunday, I will give you, as today I outlined, why you can't just relegate him to a good and wise teacher status, because the claims he made about himself, and the only Christ you will find anywhere, is making these claims intrinsic to the record, impossible to be separated. This is the kind of claimant he was. And only the resurrection gives him the right, vindicating, signifying he was who he said he was, and thus we can take him for what he claimed to be. That evidence I will give you next Sunday. But don't go out of here today ever saying, "Well, he's a good and wise teacher, and I accept him. I wouldn't reject him." No, he wasn't. He made such ridiculous claims, and you can't find a source he didn't do it in. So if you don't have a source at all, you don't even have any right to say anything about Jesus. The only source, the only evidence, is a madman or a fake. Unless it's true, I'd worship Sam and Dr. Craig Lent if they made these claims and came out of the grave. I would worship their memory and search their every word as the key to life. That's why Jesus Christ is so important to spend the hours to do what the New York University man said. He said, "I don't want to study the resurrection. The chance that it would be true, even though I think it's remote, the chance that I would be convinced that he came out of that tomb would totally uproot my philosophy, and at this stage in my life, I don't want to have to start over. So I don't even want to look." Well, I give him credit for being an honest fool. More honest than most who claim they've looked when they're but the product of this circular, no miracle reasoning. And a few questions can prove they've not even read the most basic classics on the subject. And I will give it to you next Sunday. That's my message today. Time. Next Sunday, if, like C.S. Lewis, I have adequately painted the option, either confess you know nothing about Christ, confess it, you're not willing to take the look, and quit claiming to be so snidely smart, that you're willing, just face up to it, you're willing to face the reality that you're ignoring, a historic fact that has changed the face of the world. I can respect these other founders. I may not buy Buddha's experience as the answer, or even his view of ultimate reality. I may not buy Confucius' approach. I may not buy Muhammad's claim to be a prophet, or that what he received as visions came from Allah. But I can respect them because I believe they believed it. They were not frauds. They weren't fools. Jesus doesn't belong in that camp with the outlandish claims he made about himself, and either have the courage to face the truth of history and admit your ignorance and your unwillingness to pursue it, or take the next step, the vindication, the sign, specific and impossible, was given. He hung his claims upon it. God said this is the only sign he'll give. Pay the price then to get the evidence of the resurrection. Let your own psychological response be your guide. But don't ignore by some pseudo claim of intellectualism that because it's a miracle it couldn't happen. The claim of Christianity is that because it's a miracle and is so impossible to have occurred, that becomes the vindication of his claims. And that alone is the legitimate basis for the Christian faith. I hope you'll be here next Sunday as I present the evidence. I go to the rock as the song. Good day, folks.